Stan.
A bit louder, please.
Whoops, I'll get my mic near me. I hope that's loud enough. Okay, a number of different things, as you would expect. I think the Mike Pompeo speech at the Nixon Foundation is particularly interesting and significant. He obviously chose the Nixon Foundation deliberately, and of course it isn't simply that Richard Nixon was a sort of well-known Republican right-winger. I suppose that the thing you and me would associate most closely with Richard Nixon isn't just merely getting impeached and resigning and Tricky Dicky and Watergate, but the meeting between himself and Henry Kissinger with Mao Zedong and Chou En-lai. This was of huge importance. This was in 1972, so the Vietnam War was still on. American troops were still fighting. I think they were soon to be withdrawn, but they were still fighting in Vietnam. And there you are, Mao Zedong shaking hands with Richard Nixon. This is at a time I remember the Cuban communist paper, Granma. The poor buggers had to go through every edition, and when you had the name Nixon, the X had to be spelt as a swastika. This gives you an idea of the hatred that Nixon earned from the left. That wasn't just something coming from Cuba, that was across the world. So this particular moment was of huge importance because, of course, it had been designed by Kissinger to, how should you put it, to put the squeeze on the Soviet Union, that the United States might well have known that it was just about to lose in Vietnam, but we can do one on you. And they did. And what you saw is a shift in Chinese foreign policy. So in terms of Maoists internationally, they were completely disorientated. So bizarrely, when it came to Chile, 1973, the overthrow of Allende, that is actually something that China welcomed. China also sponsored how should you put it, anti-Soviet groups in South Africa, Mozambique, Angola. One can carry on down the list. But what this paved the way for was the capitalist Rhoda Deng Xiaoping. And when he took over, the United States was more than willing to allow China to integrate with the global capitalist economy. Now, a lot of people who admire the Chinese model and say that this is some sort of example of how poor countries can enrich themselves and develop, forget the fact that China's path, China's boom, is with the say-so and full willingness and support of the United States. If you look at China, it was the recipient of $1 trillion worth of investment. Now, some of that, true, came from Hong Kong. Some of it came from Chinese business people in Singapore, Taiwan. Nonetheless, this was with the blessing of the United States. And so if we look at China's massive economic boom over the last 30 years or so, we need to understand it in a global context, but a global context that, how should you put it, that the door was open to in 1972 with the meeting between Mao, as I said, and Nixon. Now, what Mike Pompeo is saying is that after 50 years, this relationship between China and the United States is a failure. I don't think that's quite true. It's clearly a success from China's point of view, and we should also understand it as a success from the point of view of the West. All you need to do is look at your smartphone, look at the computer that you're talking or watching me over, and one can carry on down the technological list. And the chances are that it was manufactured in China. They're cheap. So China originally, yes, was a source of cheap labor. And it's certainly true that over recent years, some manufacturers have actually gone from China to places like Ethiopia. Vietnam is another country. Nonetheless, as I said, if you look at this relationship, it clearly has been a success. And what Pompeo is saying is, okay, it's been a success, but of course, what has happened is that China's rise hasn't been as the Americans wanted it, as a country that was subordinate to the United States. China hasn't allowed US firms to buy up banks and big industries. China has kept that either as state-controlled or as companies that are in effect under the wing of the state. Now, Deng Xiaoping is famous for saying about the United States, don't pull the tiger's tail. Some of us might know Mao's phrase about the United States and U.S. imperialism being a paper tiger. Well, some paper tiger. Deng Xiaoping, I think, was more accurate, that here you are, you've got the hegemonic power. It's a declining power, but don't pull its tail. Don't annoy it. And I do think that that is what's happened with China recently, that what we've seen is, yes, of course, China asserting itself in Hong Kong. No one's ever disputed that Hong Kong was part of China. But also what it's done is it's extended itself in terms of the South China Sea. We should stress that the South China Sea isn't just named because it's next door to China. The South China Sea, in terms of Chinese claims to territorial waters, goes right down south. And so we have a situation of where Vietnamese fishing boats have been boarded, their equipment has been confiscated by Chinese Navy. Similar incidents have happened in terms of the Philippines. And the United States says that it's determined to ensure international waters remain international waters. And that actually gives you an illustration of the relative powers between these two countries. Imagine the situation of the Chinese Navy patrolling, the Caribbean or the Atlantic coast of the United States. Well, that is what the United States does. Now, I've never been a believer in the inexorable rise of China, that because China was growing 10% a year over the last 20 years or so, is it destined to keep growing at 10% a year over the next 20 years and therefore inevitably overtake the United States? I don't think so, one, on the growth rates, and I don't think that hegemonic powers look upon their decline and their replacement by another hegemonic power benignly. They usually resist. And the obvious example that we have is the rise of Germany and the resistance by British imperialism. And we need to understand that British imperialism wasn't attacked by Germany in 1914. It was British imperialism that engineered World War I. After the Japanese-Russian war, you had the Anglo-French alliance deliberately go out and draw Russia in. This was to encircle Germany, and clearly the British had a plan to curb Germany's power. Yes, after 4 years, that is what it did successfully. Anyway, in terms of China and the United States, clearly Mike Pompeo and the US have a far more difficult job on their hands in terms of this new Cold War than they had in the last Cold War. I've already indicated in terms of the economies of these two countries, they're tightly bound up together. So I heard a little figure on the radio being quoted, and I can't remember it exactly, so forgive me, but it went something along the lines of how much did the Soviet Union trade with the United States? Well, on an annual basis, it was something like $3 billion, which is a lot to you and me. On the other hand, if we take China and the United States, it trades something like $3 billion daily. That gives you an indication of how closely these two economies have been tied together. So the United States is pursuing, I don't think, a strategy of cutting its links with China, but it's certainly pursuing a strategy of loosening its dependence on China. And we shouldn't forget that in terms of the two countries, who's dependent on who, I think I would say that China is far more dependent on the United States than the United States is dependent on China. You can always find another country to put together your goods. You can always find a manufacturer either internally or abroad to do what China is doing. It might be more costly, it might be less profitable, nonetheless it can be done. Okay, just lastly, of course, in terms of Britain, did Britain make its decision on 5G on the basis of an independent decision? Of course, you must be joking. This had nothing to do with the China Research Group. The China Research Group is clearly a vehicle for US imperialism, and Boris Johnson basically did what he was told. Again, I think that illustrates the actual real power balance in the world. Okay, just a very quick comment on Russia's Star War missile. I think we should take the militarization of space seriously. It's quite clear that in terms of modern communications, as well as relying on, you know, optics, it also relies on satellites, and satellites are peculiarly vulnerable to being blasted out of the sky. I think that there will be some sort of treaty banning the deployment of weapons in outer space, but clearly in terms of militarily and economically, all countries of the advanced sort are vulnerable to such an attack. Okay, turning from the US internationally to the US domestically, we have federal agents on the streets of Portland, threat to put them elsewhere. I've heard about Seattle. There's also threats in terms of Detroit, New York. What is this all about? Well, in my view, I have to say this very humbly, I didn't predict, I got it completely wrong when it came to the election of Trump. I just couldn't see how he could be elected. Either way, this strikes me as an election move. Having handled the COVID-19 virus appallingly, not just in terms of the number of deaths, I think there's 140,000 deaths in the United States, but in terms of PR, you know, this is just the flu. You don't need to wear a mask. It will go away with summer. The disinfectant stuff, the bleach remarks, the tablets, you name it, Trump has got it wrong on every single occasion. And as a result, not only in places like New York, but in the southern states, which have been hit particularly fiercely recently, we've seen his ratings go down. And in that sense, while Black Lives Matter has strengthened the hand of the Democrats in the short term, it's clear that Trump is attempting to do a Nixon. If you look back at Nixon, he won his second term, remember, not only in terms of promising to back the boys in Vietnam, but also on the basis of attacking anti-Vietnam War demonstrators in the United States. They were hippies, they were unpatriotic, they burnt American flags, they dodged the draft. You name it, this was Nixon's offensive, and he won. We shouldn't forget that he won. So again, I don't know, but I would describe what Trump is doing at the present in the light of his attempt to get re-elected in November. And having been shown to be wrong first time round, I'm being very cautious about suggesting that he doesn't have a chance, because look at the opinion polls. Of course, the sight of federal agents on the streets has provoked much talk about authoritarianism, about the forward march of fascism, including in the Weekly Worker. We led with it on the front page. Again, I would be rather cautious on that one. You could certainly say that all bourgeois states have a tendency towards whatever you want to call it. I don't like the word authoritarian in terms of the origin of that term, but we'll use it for the sake of convenience. All bourgeois states, all states of a minority class have a tendency to use force, to clamp down on free speech, free association, the right to demonstrate. That is certainly true. On the other hand, we need to understand, in terms of the capitalist class itself, it also has a tendency, it's a very broad tendency, but nonetheless almost uniquely in terms of capitalism, the ruling class shows no particular preponderance or wish to actually engage directly in the business of government. But if you look at slave owners, classically, we're talking about, they are involved in government. Classically, in terms of feudalism, the feudal class is directly engaged in government. Classically, in terms of capitalism, the business of politics and the business of business are separated. And if you want to take perhaps the exception to that general rule, I would say that the United States at least is different. Whereas in Britain, you tended to have aristocrats and nowadays, you know, middle class professional politicians in Parliament. In the United States, there are plutocrats. There are the mega rich in the Senate, in, you know, running for governors and all the rest of it. So I'm also very hesitant about the United States in terms of talk about authoritarianism, certainly fascism, because you'd have to then say, why would the capitalist class back such a move towards fascism? You know, is their wealth threatened by the rise of the working class, as it was in Germany in the 1920s? And you have to say, well, if there's a working class threat in the United States, I'd love to see it. I can't even see it. Black Lives Matter, fantastic demonstrations, inspiring in many ways, especially when you look at the makeup of demonstrations, but hardly a threat to the state, hardly a threat that would, how should I put it, persuade the ruling class to throw its lot behind some Bonapartist figure. So classically, you know, if we look at the origins of the term Bonapartism, you know, we're thinking about Napoleon III. We're thinking about the face-off between the bourgeoisie and the working class, a bourgeoisie that couldn't rule and a working class that couldn't take over, hence the rise of Bonapartism. And, a dictatorship over the bourgeoisie itself, but a dictatorship over the bourgeoisie that the bourgeoisie could be perfectly happy with. Okay, so in the United States, again, I don't see the seeds of a civil war. We're not dealing with two factions of the ruling class. We're not dealing with two factions of the ruling class divided by two systems, one a slaveocracy, another presiding over wage slavery. So again, I'm very skeptical about this. So again, I'm seeing this much more in the light of Trump's bid to be re-elected. Nevertheless, you know, these things can happen. Just lastly, who are these feds? Well, they are drawn from the border security, drug enforcement, customs, Department of Homeland Security. There are tens of thousands of them, and clearly they're operating as a paramilitary force, not a normal, in inverted commas, police force. So, who knows? Okay. Turning to Turkey, we have the first Muslim service in Hagia Sophia for 86 years. This is clearly not because Istanbul is in great need of extra space for worshippers. Last time I went to Istanbul, it was a long time ago, I readily admit, but what struck me, you know, instantly is the building work that was going on, and the building work was of mosques. At the time, this was just after the military coup. This wasn't the state sponsoring the building of mosques. It was Saudi Arabian money. That's what I was led to understand. But Istanbul is more than supplied with mosques. That's the point I'm making. They don't need to go to this former museum in order to open up space for worshippers. So clearly, and we all know it, this is of symbolic importance. We have Erdogan there. And what it's about is leaving behind, trying to bury the secular ideology of the Turkish state, as founded by Ataturk, and to take an Ottomist direction. That is to revive Turkey as not a secular state, but as a religious state. Clearly, we all know that the building originated as a Christian building. I don't really take the protestations of the Orthodox Church or the Catholic Church particularly seriously. There ain't many Christians left in Turkey, but what there are is an awful lot of people who believe in some sort of secularism. And you can certainly say that about Istanbul. The last contested elections we saw for mayor, remember they were rerun, saw the election of someone from the People's Republican Party, which has its origins with Ataturk. They defeated the AKP. So also what's going on with Erdogan Again, it could be an example of overreach. I've just talked about China in that respect. What we have with Erdogan is, how should I put it, an assertive foreign policy. So Turkey at the moment is engaged in territorial claims of large areas of the Mediterranean Sea. This sees it pitted in conflict with Greece and Cyprus, but also with Israel, Egypt, and other countries. We also see Turkish-backed troops in Libya, and the possibility of a clash between those Turkish-backed and, I think, officered troops in Libya with either Egyptian-backed troops or actual Egyptian forces. What's also worth noting when it comes to the dispute in the Eastern Mediterranean is that the EU and the United States are backing Greece and Cyprus. And of course, what we mean by Cyprus is not northern Cyprus, but southern Cyprus. And so again, we have the danger of war. I'm very hesitant to say who would win, but my suspicion would be that, you know, obviously Greece versus Turkey, it's obvious who would win. It would be Turkey. Turkey has an enormous army, but it's certainly much bigger and militarily more powerful than Greece. But a Greece backed by France, backed by Germany, certainly backed by the United States, Turkey doesn't stand a chance. What would happen, or what might happen in Libya, that's anybody's business. But what this is all about is securing control over parts of the Mediterranean in order to search for gas and oil, which there is there. Okay. Coming towards the end, the Labour Party, High Court, settlement with Panorama and the staffers who appeared on that Panorama programme. Clearly, Starmer doesn't give a bugger about the £500,000pounds that the Labour Party has spent in terms of barristers, solicitors, or payouts. The £500,000 from his point of view is well spent. This enables him to display his loyalty to British imperialism, his loyalty to British imperialist foreign policy. He's letting it be known that the Labour Party would be a loyal opposition in any war in the Middle East that involves Israel and maybe an Iran. But also, it's saying that if the Labour Party was in government, it would also be a reliable ally of the United States. That's what this is all about. It's got nothing to do with anti-Semitism. This is about foreign policy. In terms of the Labour Party, we know that it faces other legal actions. Again, I would very much expect that this will be settled, that they will throw money at it, and that if you were a former staffer, yes, you're in line, I think, for quite considerable payouts. And of course, that includes the former General Secretary, Ian McNichol, who is not only suing, but I suspect will be in receipt of money pretty soon. We've also seen threats to sue Jeremy Corbyn. I don't know what his legal fund, not set up by him, I hasten to add, but the last time I read, it was something like £210,000. I'm sure it's well over £250,000 by now. What a pity that Jeremy Corbyn is calling out this particular judgment and didn't call out the whole of the witch hunt and didn't actually fight this witch hunt from the beginning. And indeed, isn't it a tragedy that Jeremy Corbyn and his allies actually became complicit agents of this witch hunt? And I'm not just talking about John Landsman, who has also issued a statement apologising for doubting the veracity of the Panorama programme and attacking the whistleblowers who broke their contract with the Labour Party. I'm also talking about Jenny Formby and the machine that she put in place. These people also engaged in witch hunting people, indeed to the point where if you said that there was no anti-Semitic problem in the Labour Party, they called you a denier and therefore guilty of an offence under Labour Party rules. Okay. We have, as a result of all of this, no surprise from the Socialist Party in England and Wales, a call to the other sponsors of the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, which has been in sort of suspended animation for the last couple of years, to revive it. What they're calling for is a new mass workers' party. It might be conceivable that they managed to keep RMT on board, given what's going on in the Labour Party. I don't know about the SWP, whether it would come back on board or whether it will be so obsessed with chasing Black Lives Matter. Either way, the politics are extraordinarily low. They're basically classical economism. So they're not raising the question of socialism and fighting the existing constitution. It really is paying conditions, National Health Service, and other such stuff. Not that we wanted to cry those questions, but clearly in terms of a genuinely socialist program, an awful lot more is needed. The working class needs to become the hegemonic class in society if it's to become the ruling class in society. The last item I want to deal with is out of my normal comfort zone, I readily confess. I hadn't heard of Wiley until the last week. Wiley is a grime artist. I've looked at his various credits. He's clearly a very successful artist. And again, I wasn't not only unaware of him, I wasn't aware, therefore, of his views. And so, yeah, over the last few days, we've had splash headlines, you know, anti-Semitic outrage, and Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, intervening, attacking Facebook and Instagram. Why haven't you removed these postings? How comes they were up for a day? What was the guy saying? Well, again, I've not read everything. I've tried to look at his official site. It seems to be down. So I've done my best to find out what he's been saying. And he's basically been saying things like, well, the Jewish people and the KKK are basically the same. They're immovable. They consider themselves beyond criticism. He's also come out with formulations that might mislead the naive, that Jewish people in Israel are living in a land that doesn't belong to them. And he's also talked about, you know, Jews dominating the law, and the role of Jewish businessmen, no doubt including his former management company. Either way, what ought to be pointed out is that that these views aren't simply, from what I can gather, and again, my ability to research is very limited, but these views aren't plucked out of thin air, and these views actually are part of, from what I can understand, a coherent world view. And this isn't a Nazi or white supremacist worldview, obviously, but it is the view of a religious, how should we put it, sect is the wrong word. It's a religious strand, that's the better word, because it contains a whole number of different groupings and elements within it. Suffice to say, from my understanding, is he is an adherent at some level of Black Hebrew-ism. Sometimes it's called Black Israelis, sometimes Black Jews. This is a movement that has its origins in the United States in the late 19th century, and it's the view that some, I don't know how many, but some former slaves, or maybe all former slaves in the United States, are the biological inheritors of the tribe of Judea, one of the Israeli tribes that the Bible talks about. And this is based on the myth of the Romans driving out the inhabitants of the Jewish inhabitants of Palestine after the defeat of the Jewish Revolution. This is based on the idea that they didn't go to Eastern Europe, to Spain, and all the rest of it, but they went to Africa, and it was white slave traders that took this tribe of Judea into slavery in the United States. So this group comes together in the late 19th century. It spreads to the Caribbean, so there are synagogues of this particular group there. It's had a very up and down history. It's never been huge. So sometimes there's been something like 200 congregations. It's split into many different, as I said, strands. Some of them actually ended up in Israel proper, and for some time they were denied Israeli citizenship and rights. But that has changed, and indeed one black Hebrew actually represented Israel in the European Song Contest. So these people in Israel have been much more integrated. Whitney Houston apparently visited them in Israel. But yeah, these people, at least some of them, believe that Jews in Israel are interlopers, and Israel actually belongs to black people who are the real Jews. Very complicated, I know. No real basis in actual history. But then when we look at religion and actual history, we obviously see a disjuncture at many different levels. But the point I'm really trying to make is that rather than viewing this as the outburst of somebody who has mental problems, that is simply, you know, babbling on in a crazy way about Jews occupying a land that isn't theirs, being in hand in hand with white society that oppresses black people, that this is an expression of religion. And therefore we get into a much more complex territory because, okay, Priti Patel says that these views are abhorrent. Well, I agree with her that they're abhorrent. But on the other hand, here we are today, it's a Sunday, and all over England, all over Western Europe and the United States and many other countries besides, there will be preachers opening the Bible and either reading from the Old Testament or the New Testament. And I would say that I would find it very easy to find whole passages in either book of the Christian Bible So I'm talking about the Jewish Bible and the Christian Bible. I would find it very easy to find all sorts of remarks from the mouth either of Jesus or from the mouth of God that are deeply abhorrent. So if we look at the New Testament, it gets progressively more anti-Semitic to the point of where the Jews are blamed for killing the Son of God. And the Jews proclaim in front of the Romans that not only are they guilty of killing the Son of God, but all their children and their children's children down the generations are guilty of this crime. And of course, that was used in medieval Europe to justify anti-Semitism, which was at the time a form of class warfare. When it comes to the so-called Old Testament, well, what you have there is God advocating genocide, that every man, woman and children of this or that tribe should be wiped out, and not even an ox or a goat or a sheep should be left. Everything should be killed. Well, I don't take it literally. I don't take it as, how should you put it, instructions that continue that Jewish people should go out there and wipe out all Canaanites and all Philistines and all the rest of the list that they were told to exterminate. Nonetheless, when we get into freedom of speech, it is worth noting that when Tony Blair drew up his religious hatred legislation, holy books had to be explicitly left out. That if you were a comedian, you might be found guilty. If you were a politician, you were found guilty. But if you were a preacher, if you were someone quoting one of these books, they didn't want to go there. And that's really what I'm trying to point out about Priti Patel and the question of freedom of speech. I'm in favour of freedom of speech. And if you favour freedom of speech, you have to accept that some people will say something that is offensive to you. Christians constantly say things that are offensive to me. So do Muslims, so do Jews, so do conservatives, so do Labourites and all the rest of it. I just have to learn to live with it. And there's a huge difference between saying something that's offensive and doing something equivalent of saying fire in the middle of a crowded cinema. So I do look at what's going on with concern, that clearly there's a creepage going on there in terms of what various media companies allow to be put up. And it's clear that if this Wiley guy can be closed down, it's clear that we'll be seeing legislation not before long that will actually criminalise such postings. When that gets caught up with the religion, obviously it's going to be a difficult question for the state to disentangle those two questions, but nonetheless, that is what is going on in front of our eyes at the moment.